In the previous presentation, we looked at a faith view. John presenting to us his basic faith, and that was the woman and the dragon representing good and evil. Now it comes to their experience there, and we need to locate the woman. Where is the woman in this world that we're living, and where is the dragon? So we have to locate it, and we have to do it too for our community too, but these churches, he's trying to help them see where the Christ-bearing woman is and where the dragon is that's trying to destroy it. He's going to be looking at the historical incarnation of evil, and he'll locate it as the Roman Empire. And good, the woman, is the church. Chapter 12, verse 13. So when the dragon saw that he'd been thrown down to earth, he pursued the woman who'd given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle, so that she could fly from the serpent into the wilderness to her place where she's nourished for a time, times, plural, and half a time. Three and a half, again, in a different way of putting it. A period of persecution. So the kind of energy that sought to destroy Christ wants to destroy the church. They crucify Jesus when they're trying to destroy the community. The church is still journeying, and so finds itself in a desert on the way to the promised land, but not there yet, here. God, however, gives to the disciples of Jesus the power to rise above the temptations of evil and to come to him on the wings of the great eagle. Once again, John uses an animal image, the eagle, to signify the incomprehensible nature of God's protective activity. Book of Daniel, chapter 7 and chapter 12, repeated. The saints will be given into his power for a time, two times, and half a time. Exactly what our quote, it's been quoted here by John. In the book of Exodus, chapter 19, verse 4, we read, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself, to the holy mountain Sinai." So that's an image that's behind our text. Just as God took the people from Egypt, bypassed the garrisons, etc., and led them into the desert, to his holy mountain where he appeared to them and gave them the Torah, so now God is protecting the church by raising her up, taking her into the desert. In Isaiah chapter 40, verse 31, we read, "Those who wait for the Lord renew their strength. They shall mount up with eagle's wings." The Apocalypse text continues, "Then from his mouth the serpent poured water like a river after the woman to sweep her away with the flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman. It opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. Comment: the dragon has been thrown down to earth. It's deceptive. It takes on the subtle and temptive form of a serpent. Water seems to be just what is needed to transform the desert. However, the temptations faced by the churches of Asia Minor to accommodate to the Roman Empire are intended to sweep the church away. They're thirsty, and here's water. Why not drink it? So the ruse of the serpent, the cunning serpent, fails. Then, writes John, the devil, the dragon, was angry with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her children, those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. Then the dragon took his stand on the sand of the seashore. Having failed to deceive, evil shows itself in its real colours. No longer as the serpent, but as the dragon. It stands in readiness for conflict with the church. Fittingly, the dragon stands on the sand of the sea, for it comes from chaos, the sea, image of chaos in the Jewish world, to destroy God's creation. We're reminded of the book of Genesis. I will put enmity between you and the woman, to the serpent, between your offspring and hers. So he's setting up the scene for the conflict. I saw, says John, a beast rising out of the sea. And remember, that's how the Romans came to Asia Minor. They were a maritime power. I saw the beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns, 7 heads, and on its horns were 10 diadems. And on its heads were blasphemous names. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's. Its mouth like a lion's mouth. And the dragon gave to this beast the power and throne and great authority. So our question is, what is this beast that's been given power by the dragon? John's imagery comes from the description given in the book of Daniel of the empires which subjugated Judah. Chapter 7 of the book of Daniel. I won't go into all that with you. The text continues, one of its heads seemed to have received a death blow, but its mortal wound had been healed. At the time that John is writing, some thought that the Emperor Domitian was a reincarnation of Nero. Nero Redivivus, they called him. Nero come back to life. The idea of someone coming back to life in another person doesn't, it's part of my culture or yours, but it was theirs. You remember Herod thought that Jesus was John the Baptist, come back to life. So here it is, they're thinking this Nero has died, killed, wounded, but he's come back to life now in Domitian. That's the death blow, the mortal wound that's been healed. text, in amazement, the whole earth followed the beast that came out of the sea. They worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast?" And we know more than, because we've just read the bit from last presentation. Michael, mi, hu, ka, Hebrew, like, el, God. Mikael means who is like God, meaning, of course, no one. Here, the beast is saying, who is like the beast? The power. Who can fight against it? The beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. Again, back to 3.5, period of depression, period of persecution before the rising, the dying before the rising. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. I think you've guessed your way already in this. You're so in touch with it, and I'll try and help you a bit. The arrogance and blasphemy uttered by the dragon is also modelled on Daniel, where we read in the book, chapter 11, the king shall act as he pleases. He shall exalt himself and consider himself greater than any god, and shall speak horrendous things against the God of gods. He shall prosper until the period of wrath is completed, for what is determined shall be done, says the prophet, says Daniel. And our text continues. Also, it was allowed, this beast, to make war on the saints and to conquer them. It was given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all the inhabitants of the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slaughtered. And then comes a central statement of the book of Apocalypse. We're remembering the letters. Let anyone who has ear listen. This is his key message. And it's the key message of all apocalyptic literature. If you are to be taken captive, well, go into captivity. If you kill with the sword you must be killed. Here is a call for the endurance and faithfulness of the saints. The book of Apocalypse, the book of Daniel, the book of the Apocalypse is a call to endure and be faithful. I can't think of a better summary than the whole book. For them, and we for us now. And then in 13, verse 11, then I saw another beast that rose out of the earth. The other one from the sea, this is one from the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It looked like a lamb. That's a positive thing. It wasn't, but it looked like it. But it actually spoke like the dragon. It exercised all the authority of the first beast on its behalf. It makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound has been healed, worshipping Domitian, the emperor, the beast from the sea, the Roman Empire. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in the sight of all. And by the signs that it is allowed to perform on behalf of the beast, it deceives the inhabitants of the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that has been wounded. They're making images. They've got temples to the god, temples to the emperor. Make an image for the beast that has been wounded by the sword and yet come back to life. Just as Nero had killed Paul and Peter, as you know, 30 years earlier, so the Roman Empire, working its way through the local government from the earth, the local ones who are buying it and getting power from it and leading it. The beast is a symbolic depiction of the false apostles who've already featured in the letters to the churches. We met Jezebel earlier. Those who are either from the state or even those in the community that are buying into the Roman system. It was allowed. So there's a providence happening. He's trying to remind us that there's an overarching providence here. Don't let's forget God's action. So it's allowed to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast could even speak and cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right arm or the forehead, the way they marked slaves. So people are being made slaves to the system, to the empire. Those who refuse to worship the emperor and his image are being handed over to be killed. Those who follow the Roman way are slaves of Rome in their way of living or in their way of thinking. What they do with their arm is what Rome says to do, and their mind has been seduced. And our text continues. And that no one can buy or sell who does not have the mark. Christians have been excluded from the economic social system. That is, the name of the beast or the numbers of its name. This calls for wisdom. So this is very esoteric stuff now. It's not going to make all this public. There's enough persecution going on. So this is written to encourage the Christians, but anyone else trying to read it wouldn't know what the heck it was about. But it requires wisdom. So he's telling us, watch this carefully. Let anyone with understanding calculate the number of the beast. That's the one that came out of the sea. For it's the number of a person. Number is 666, which we've all heard about all our life. Well, relax, you're about to get an idea of what it means. 666, the number of the beast. Okay, the enigmatic 666, which John concludes this passage, has given rise to much speculation. One suggestion, and I'll just offer you the various suggestions. One suggestion is that 666 refers to the Emperor Domitian. who is the reincarnation of Nero. Now, Hebrew letters have a standard numerical equivalence. Aleph, for example, the first letter of the alphabet, means one. Beth means two, etc. So every number has got every letter has a certain number. If you take the title Nero, Neron, Kaiser in Hebrew, does in fact add up to 666. He said it was the number of a person. It's highly likely the person is Nero. Is Nero reincarnated, Domitian. Such an interpretation fits perfectly well with the whole of the apocalypse. And now, just for your interest, N is worth 50 in Hebrew, R is 200, W, or the long O, is 6, it's the sixth letter of the alphabet, N is 50. Q is 100, S is 60, R is 200. Don't break your brain over it. But if you added all those numbers together, Neron, say, Kaiser, you would get 666. And that's one very strong opinion offered by scholars as to the meaning. And it makes complete sense to me, anyhow. However, there are other suggestions. A second suggestion appears at first sight to be far-fetched, or did to me anyhow. It's, however, typical of the way in which the rabbis enjoyed playing with numbers. So did the early Christians. Augustine loved all this, getting numbers and working them out. So let's play the game for a minute. According to this suggestion, the number 666 is linked with the Hebrew word for truth, emet, aleph, mem, tau, which has a numerical equivalent of 441. Numbers which, when added together, come up to 9, 4 plus 4 plus 1. Because of its special mathematical qualities, and its link with the word truth, this is in the Jewish world, 9 was considered the divine number. 9, double 9 is 18, 8 and 1 is 9, triple 9 is 27, 2 and 7 is 9, 36, 9, you with me? It's quite an extraordinary number. Can work your way right through and it keeps adding up to 9. So it's the kind of divine number. The link comes about because 6 plus 6 plus 6 is 18. 8 plus 1 is 9. A thought. Perhaps John is saying that the beast has the divine number, meaning that however ferocious it may appear, in the ultimate analysis, it's under God, and so cannot prevail against God and cannot destroy God's kingdom. That's a second suggestion you might like to play with. It's not at all impossible. Now, the threefold repetition of the number 6, which is half 12 and one short of 7, 12 is the heavenly fullness, 7, the seven-branch candlesticks, etc., is earthly completion. Well, 6 is just one under it. It may simply be meant to symbolize the summit of godlessness and evil, the fullness of incompletion before the 7. I think that's least likely, but I offer it to you. A generation later, after the writing of the Apocalypse, and this should give us some pause, Irenaeus, who was born in Asia Minor, born in this area and so can be expected to have been familiar with the milieu in which the Apocalypse was written, warned against wild guessing in attempts to interpret this enigmatic symbol in his book Against the Heresies, book 5, chapter 30. So here he is 100 years later saying all these, everyone's coming up with their suggestions, I've just come up with three, and he's telling us, look, be very careful what you're doing with this. John, as you've just read, insists that, quote, this calls for wisdom. I think the point is that each generation has to use similar wisdom to discern false prophecy and false propaganda in its own world. What is the 666 for us, for Australian Christians? What is the 666? What is the... We have to use wisdom to work out what are the forces that are fighting against Christ and the church and faith. So back to our text, chapter 14 of the Apocalypse. Then I saw, and behold, he wants them to see it too. I saw it, so look. I saw the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him the 144,000, all those who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads, all those whose thinking is determined by their faith and are faithful to their to what they know to be right. Prior to the final conflict between the forces of evil and the forces of good, and prior to the announcing of the hour of God's judgment, we are taken to Jerusalem, the city of God, to see the crucified and risen Christ. We know already that's what the lampstand saw. And with him, the church victorious, the saints. The 144,000 symbolizes the universal or Catholic dimension of the church. The word Catholic, you probably know, the first time we see it in writing is in the very first years of the second century, in a book, in a letter from Ignatius of Antioch to one of the churches in Asia Minor, some 6 or 7 years after this book of the Apocalypse. That's the first usage of it. And it was the usage we didn't invent, the church didn't invent the word Catholic, it was the name given to the church because it was a surprising religious phenomenon. It was all-embracing, which is what Catholic means. It was welcoming of all. You didn't have to be male or female, you could be either. You didn't have to be rich or poor, you could be either. You didn't have to be in the military or the civilian life, you could be either. It seemed to bring in anybody, which other religions didn't do. They had their fences and their doors and their mithra, etc. So, but this Christian church seemed to be, they couldn't nail it down. It was Catholic, universal, all-embracing. So the 144,000 symbolise the universal, we've met that number, of course, 12,000, or Catholic dimension of the church, comprising all those who've been have the crucified and exalted Jesus as their Lord. They are slaves of Christ. Paul called himself that. And he prayed for the mind of Christ and the heart of Christ. And his father, having his father's name written on their forehead. Right back in chapter 3 of the Apocalypse, we read, if you conquer, if you win the battle against evil, if you conquer, I'll make you a pillar in the temple of my God, and you'll never go out of it. I write on you the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem that comes down from my God out of heaven. It's a gift. It's a grace coming from God. And we'll see a little later, it's the church. The letter to the Hebrews, written much earlier, probably in Rome, probably in the 50s, 60s, reads, "You have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering." This is the church meeting on the first day of the week, Sunday Mass. "You've come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and so to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to a judge who is the God of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood." Right throughout the history of the church, from the beginning right till today, sadly, and I don't, well, I'll just say sadly, people tend to leave the church because there are sinners in it at the highest level or lowest level, whether you put high and low. There are sinners in the church, of course there are. But that can't be a reason for leaving this. Because the sinners in the church, including us, are sinners to the degree that we don't live the life of the church. It's not as if the church impels us to evil. On the contrary. So there's all the more reason for, just as in the life of Jesus, he ate with sinners, and that was what he got into trouble for. He eats with sinners. So they were right down on him. And they were wrong. Of course he eats with sinners. Of course there are sinners. The church is not there to promote sin, but if I don't listen humbly, receive the Eucharist, then it's likely that I too will drift away and use this as a reason for drifting away. People left Jesus' community because of the sinners in their midst, because there were Samaritans in there, because there was a woman caught in adultery who was there, and Jesus didn't condemn her. So we're dealing with something that's been there forever. But we do have to help each other go deeper in our faith. It doesn't rely on innocence. It relies on grace and gift and all the beautiful things that the letter to the Hebrews has said and that the apocalypse will soon be saying to us about the woman, about the mother, about the risen Christ active in the world. The apocalypse continues. "I heard a voice from heaven like the sound of many waters, like the sound of loud thunder. And the voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps, and they sing a new song before the throne and before the four animal-like creatures and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who have been redeemed from the earth." Symbolic number, clearly. "It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. These follow the Lamb wherever he goes. They've been redeemed from humankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb, and in their mouth no lie was found. They are blameless. we're using very strong metaphors here. We better be careful how we use them. The temples in those days also had cultic prostitutes. And there were festivals that went on where the males would have sex with the prostitutes, and the whole point of it was, in their mind, was for the sake of the harvest. If the seed can be given and fruitful, then the seed that they're planting will also be fruitful. There's a lot more to it than that, but that's a lot to do with it. Well, these communities, they're not going to the temple. They're not going to defile themselves with women, is what he calls it. They're virgins. Now, that's got nothing at all to do. They're married men and married women, most of them. Celibacy was not a common thing in the Jewish world. It wasn't there at all, really, or hardly at all. Certainly because they wanted everyone to be to bring forth the Messiah. That was their job. That was their duty, their married duty. So virginity was very looked on askance, and when the word virgin appears in the Old Testament, it's always a negative. It's a virgin Israel means Israel who hasn't been productive, never gave birth. So virgin, what's virgin mean here? Who is a virgin? Isn't a virgin, male or female, the one who gives his or her first love? Seek first the kingdom of God. So married man, married woman, of course they, in this sense, they are virgins. If they give their first love to God. And that doesn't mean God and then my wife second. It means my wife and God in her. In other words, if we don't love people in a sacred way, we're not loving them very well at all. If we're not loving them in God, then whatever, we could go down that track and I don't intend to, but love is meant to be a sacrament. It's meant to be love. And of course, in the church, right from the beginning, there have been, unusual to have it, but there have been physical virgins too. There have been men and women who've wanted to love the way Jesus loved, not just compassion, but in the way he loved. In other words, they've, like Paul says, I'd like you all to be like me, giving their life to the mission of the community. There have been people like that forever, and still are. I hope I haven't said too much to confuse you there, but in this particular text, it's talking about the community who've given their first love, leave biology out of it, to God. Seek first the kingdom and everything else will be yours. They haven't committed adultery, and that text has been used all the way, that image, for false gods. They've been worshipping the true God and they've kept their first love for this God. Now comes an interlude, promising that the good will be victorious and the evil will be condemned. Chapter 14, verse 6 reads, Then I saw an angel, another angel, flying in mid-heaven with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. He said, the angel, in a loud voice, Fear God. Give God glory, for the hour of God's judgment has come. Worship God who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water. And another angel, a second, followed, saying, Fallen, fallen is Babylon, symbol now obviously of Rome. Babylon the Great. She has made all nations drink of the wine of her fornication, worshipping gods that aren't God, including the emperor, of course. So the fall of Babylon became, in Jewish literature, a symbol for the fall of all those who oppose God and his chosen people. In the situation in which John is writing, the force opposing God's people, they have to locate the dragon, and it's the Roman Empire. That's putting it very simply, but that's how John's putting it, abruptly. This is the first of seven statements concerning God's judgment of Rome and of those who've been seduced by the allurement of wealth and power into opposing God. The imagery, Babylon has fallen, comes from Jeremiah, who's talking about the real Babylon. And the text goes on, then another angel, a third, followed them, crying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and its image, the beast from the sea and its image, the local potentates or whatever, and receives a mark on the forehead or arm, is made themselves a slave to the system, he will also drink the wine of God's wrath, poured unmixed into the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur. Sodom and Gomorrah, the images in the Old Testament and the New, in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up from heaven forever and ever. There is no rest day or night for those who worship the beast and its image, the beast from the sea and the beast from the Lamb. Rome, the empire, and those who locate it in the local district. And for anyone who receives the mark of its name, slaves of the oppressor. Here is a call, repetition already, I've said it once, here it is again. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints. Endure, be faithful, stay with your faith. Those who keep the commandments of God and hold fast to the faith of Jesus. It's a lovely, important point of interpretation. Faith of Jesus. Take it slowly because it's so rich and so important. All you've got there is two nouns, faith and Jesus. And one of them's in the possessive case, namely Jesus. So he's talking about faith, the faith that we associate with Jesus. But it doesn't have any preposition. It doesn't say faith in Jesus. It doesn't say faith from Jesus. It just says Jesus' faith. Jesus' faith. The faith that's... So, yes, some translated faith in Jesus. That's an interpretation. It's not wrong. But it's adding something to the text. The text just actually says Jesus' faith. And I think that's the best way to translate it. I think it's the faith of Jesus. It's Jesus' faith given to us. He gave us his spirit. He gave us his prayer. He gave us his Father. He gave us his faith, his hope, his love. The Christian life is not me imitating Jesus. That sounds a bit silly, to be quite honest. How could you imitate Jesus? We're not supposed to imitate each other. It's, Paul says, I live no longer I, it's Christ living in me. It's his, I don't have to become patient like Jesus, I have to let Jesus' patience take over. And I get out of the road. I have to want to have Jesus' faith. Wouldn't that be a beautiful gift? Wouldn't it be good to have Jesus' love? His love. Not just me loving like him, but his love. I think that is surely the essence of Christian life. It's Christ living in us. So those who keep the commandments of God and hold fast to this gift that they've been given in baptism, we're given the gift of Jesus' priesthood, priest, his prophetic role, prophet, as you're anointed at the baptism, and king, so his reign on earth. It's all gift. And we're not supposed to believe in Jesus rather than believe in someone else and we become the subject of our verbs. We're supposed to let him live in us. The faith of Jesus. His faith in God was wonderful and to the end. Wouldn't it be beautiful if we knew that was the gift we're given and held it? That's what John's begging of communities. I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this. Earlier he'd said, don't write it yet. We're ready now. Write it. Etch it into stone. Blessed and happy, I'd say. It's the second time this has appeared. Are the dead who from now on die in the Lord. If you're going to die, we'll all die. But if by holding on to this you are persecuted, killed, then blessed are you. Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labours, their deeds follow them. And then the text continues. Then I looked, and there was a white cloud, and seated on the cloud was one like the Son of Man, with a golden crown on his head, a victory crown, and a sharp sickle in his hand. Another angel came out of the temple, calling in a loud voice to the one who sat on the cloud, use your sickle, reap, for the hour to reap has come. The harvest of the earth is fully ripe. So the one who sat on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. The harvest has come. The final judgment. The final judgment carried out by Christ himself is of the just. He's answering the martyrs' prayers which rise from the altar in the temple, back in chapter 8 and chapter 15. Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. Then another angel came out from the altar, the angel who has authority over fire, and he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, use your sickle, gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for the grapes are ripe. So the angel swung his sickle over the earth and gathered the vintage of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. The wine press was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the wine press as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia. 200 meters, if you want to put it in modern terms. So we've had two judgments. The angel, the good, and the evil. We'll do more of it, of course, tomorrow. But this is what God, this is how God judges things. This is how things really are in Laodicea and Ephesus and Smyrna and the rest in Douglas Park. We're going to watch what God's judgment is, because that's what we want to know. And in order that we be, when the sickle goes through the harvest, that we be saved, lifted into God's communion, He's asking us, hold on to the faith of Jesus.